Welcome to the El Arpa podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk. Welcome to the 100 episode extravaganza bonanza of the El Arpa podcast. It's been 100 episodes, Mary.
Yay!
What is your highlight for you?
All of them.
I particularly loved how you said hello in episode 27.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, there's a chirpiness in your voice that day I've rarely heard since, which makes me a bit sad, actually.
From 27 until now.
Yeah.
That's a few years.
We should probably talk about that off camera. Off microphone. That's one thing that hasn't changed. Me confusing the microphone with a camera.
True.
But we have seriously been doing this for the last 100 episodes.
Yes.
Sometimes it feels like it.
Oh,
especially
you.
When you correct me like that. Mm. But yeah, so thank you very much for staying with us for 100 episodes. We've gone on leaps and bounds, and we have so many new listeners all the time around the world. A lot more from Germany this week for some reason. So thank you very much for tuning in from Germany. And no matter where you are in the world, you are equally as valuable to us, especially if you listen to us on Radio Public. But more about that in part three. So the Christmas season is upon us, Mary.
Yes, it's upon us.
You've been writing an article for a blog about grammatical structures in
all
Irish.
Things being upon us.
Yeah, so what is upon us in a Gaelic sense?
Yeah, any mood. Yeah. So like happiness or sadness. Loneliness.
Exactly. So basically, when you're expressing yourself in Irish, the structure is something is upon me. We've said it in other podcasts as well. But you're going to be exploring that theme a little bit more in our blog, irishsliceofmadrid.wordpress.com. We'll leave a link in the description and you can find it there as well. We've also done an article recently of Irish refugees in Spain in the latter half of the 1600s. Well, basically the turn of the century from the 1600s to the 1700s. Under Philip II and Philip III, and how it's not really a modern concept, even though it's something that we see in modern newspapers. The idea of seeking political and religious refuge has been with us for a long time, and the complications that can happen when you have that great movement of people with different aspirations, and how they're received to varying extents by their host country as well. Again, things that play out in modern times was also playing out in Madrid. And Spain in general, but particularly Madrid, with the Irish community fleeing for their lives and also for their political refuge in the 1700s. You can check out that blog post as well. But that's kind of more part three stuff anyway. But Christmas is upon us, as I said. With my students, I've been doing a lot of Christmas adverts. Do you have any particular favourites? I know you lived in England for a few years. It's very big there, this tradition of like Sainsbury, M&S.
Max and Spencer's.
Some combination of letters there.
Yeah, yeah. Normally they have. Well, there was one of like, I don't know, they look through a telescope and...
The Man in the Moon, yeah.
So, yeah. That was last year, I think, actually.
That was 2 years.
I must have seen that on the internet.
Yeah.
So while I was living there, I don't remember, to be honest, because it used to really stress me out because the volume of things to do with Christmas and consumerism is much bigger than in Spain.
Well, you're not alone because I've actually looked into the marketing of Christmas adverts, and Christmas adverts that sell, I guess ironically sell, but portray a traditional aspect or play on traditional and familial themes score a lot higher with audiences than other types of Christmas adverts, even though they're very popular. For example, Buster the Boxer, the dog on the trampoline, isn't a very Christmas advert in terms of... okay, you haven't seen it, no?
No.
It's a dog. Well, it's basically this family in England, and the father like sets up a trampoline. It's like the Santa's gift, and she's in bed asleep, the kid. And you can see the dog looking longingly at the structure while it's been constructed. And then at nighttime, all these animals, these badgers and these foxes and all that, hedgehogs jump on it, and the dog looks very forlornly at it. And then in the morning, the kid jumps out of bed, runs down, you know, what has Santa brought? they open the patio door, she runs out, and then the dog runs past her and starts jumping on the trampoline. You haven't seen this, no?
No, I haven't seen it.
There was a hashtag.
Sounds weird.
360 experience and a VR experience in the stores as well. I think it was Sainsbury's, I think, who did it. But you can go to their shop and there's a lot of other stuff apart from the advert in the shop, which is kind of like a unique way of doing Christmas adverts as well. But even though like that is a very memorable one, because it is obviously very funny and all that kind of stuff, it never really scores with my students in the same way that an emotional, traditional Christmas advert would. I don't mean like traditional as in it's been made 20 years ago, but even a modern one that could kind of hit those themes as well. Have you seen the Hero one where there's like old people that were teddy bears and then at the very last scene they turn into humans? No?
No.
No idea what that's about either.
I haven't seen any Christmas adverts that are not Spanish this year.
One for the lottery.
Other than the orangutan one.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah. Which is, I think we mentioned that in a previous podcast
as
well.
Yeah, we did.
But apart from that, there is one from, it is Sainsbury's again, in 2014 for the centenary of World War I. It's really interesting to see that in Spanish classrooms because I don't know it's a true story.
By the teddy bears?
No, this is about the Christmas truce and the footballers.
Yes, okay, I remember that.
So again, it's like these adverts are insane because they obviously have a lot of production values and a lot of budget going into them. But in terms of, I think Sainsbury's, I know I keep mentioning them and not the other shops that do these things. Like I think Tesco's are famous for doing bad adverts. I'm not sure
why.
In general, I haven't looked into it in too much detail.
Yeah.
But Sainsbury, for example, though, they are one of the few brands who use hashtags with their slogans. So they were the ones to initiate it, and they've been very successful with their Christmas adverts. Aldi, take the Mickey, I was going to say it. I've sworn in podcasts before, so.
What? I mean, like.
Anyway, but their kind of marketing campaigns is kind of like referencing how they're not other shops. And then, like, I think their most recent one is like. The John Lewis advert comes on air and the Aldi advert is like, oh yes, it's a time of the year, the John Lewis advert. So it's kind of tongue in cheek.
Mm-hmm.
Their campaign is about waiting for the campaign of another supermarket. So I don't know what meaning you can extract from that in any deep sense. But
well, I think, I don't know, you have to do something a little bit lighter. I have to say there was like a real obsession people really liked. Even like the M&S. Actually, this year, I have seen one which was...
You lied in our 100th episode.
The no, shame on me. The Elton John one.
Oh, I have heard a lot about it.
You said John Lewis.
Elton John Lewis.
No, like, well, this is a joke. Like, yeah, it's been rude. But no, I think it was for John Lewis.
Yeah, I heard it's a great ad. I haven't seen it yet though, so I'll check it out.
I wasn't like, I don't know, I wasn't that forced to be honest, but maybe I'm just getting very cynical.
Because it's not traditional though, is it?
Well, no, it's just about how it just shows like his whole life basically, and then how it all started when he got a piano when he was little for Christmas.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which I assume is true, but I don't really know. And then in the end, it's just him like playing the piano, thinking of all that, of like when he was little.
Yeah, but all the bad singers got instruments for Christmas too.
What?
All the bad singers.
Yeah, got pianos for Christmas.
Or instruments. think of the worst singer you've ever heard of, and that person has probably gotten an instrument for Christmas.
Okay.
So is that all good?
Okay. Absolutely. All right. Yeah. We'll leave it there.
I don't want
to name anybody.
One final thing. We could say about adverts though, is that there's one, it's a great one, there's one from the Film English website, which is about a Polish guy who's learning English to, you don't know why he's learning English, but basically he's going over to England to meet his grandson because his son has married a local and they have a kid who presumably speaks only English, and it kind of builds up the story really nicely and shows how English can be a gateway to something, but also it's a Christmas movie because he's coming at Christmas to know his family, so it's kind of those two elements there of Christmas uniting families but also language uniting people in a very tender way as well. So and also there's a one which is very, it's kind of depressing, it's a German one where a grandfather pretends he's died because his family haven't come to his house for Christmas for a few years. And then they all come tearful and black and sad, and then he's like, well, and he comes out, you know, he's just like, well, I needed an excuse to get us all together for a party, and everybody's laughing at everything as well. Yeah. It's very emotional.
Well,
yeah, it's great.
I would kill him.
Well, yeah.
Since he was in debt, you know.
Go back and finish the job.
Yeah. They're quite different from Spanish ones, though. Like, in Spain, we have two that are very famous, and they've been the same advert ever since, and that's why they're popular.
Well, there's one
because everybody knows, like, the little jingle and stuff.
But there's also there's a woman who's always in them, no? Or just last year, or 2 years ago, was the old woman in the lottery one.
Oh, it was just then. The lottery one is the only one that is different, but it started like in 2000 or something like that. I mean, yeah. It didn't used to... They were saying that on TV the other day about how everybody thinks it's always existed, but it hasn't. But the one I was talking about was about... it was like for Turon.
Oh, wow.
Like Christmas.
The worst nougat. Confectionery in the world.
What are you talking about?
Oh, I know. Turon is nougat. Yeah, I'm thinking of something else.
Oh, no, you're thinking polvorones.
Yeah.
The thing that is really dry and...
Seco.
Yeah, no.
I'm seco of that, that's for sure. The Coca-Cola adverts, were they in Spain? Okay, I'm sorry. Sorry
it's
for all that.
Right, well, people don't even know what it is. So
but no, 100 episodes... sorry, that's not what I wanted to say. The Coca-Cola advert. Was that famous in Spain?
No. Okay. The holidays are coming, holidays.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, no, because they're not holidays, it's Christmas.
Yeah, well, even so, it's always Christmas in Ireland as well, but yeah. Traditionally... It wasn't Christmas until...
I know, I hate it when people say that.
Well, I guess, yeah, but it is a nice advert.
It's a consumerist thing to say.
Well, actually, it's funny because now they can't really bring that truck around that much anymore because people are worried that they're promoting unhealthy habits and they have to give water at these events where they kind of pull up the truck and meet people and they can only give Coke if asked by a child and if that child isn't accompanied by an adult. They signed 10 million concession forms or something like that.
Is it truck electric?
Well, it should be, I guess, yeah. If they want to kind of, I don't know, downplay the other criticism that they can kind of like...
Well, exactly, yeah. I mean, you know.
And then Ireland, yeah, there's one famous one from the 90s as well where like there's three kids leaving out Kellogg's cornflakes for Santa. And that girl who actually sees Santa in the adverts and then the next day she's like, ho, 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 she went to my university. Believe it or not.
And
she was there at the same time as me, roughly. But also, there's another one, which is most recent, of Guinness, which is like Dublin in the snow. Very kind of magical advert. And it's like, even at the home of the black stuff, they're dreaming of a white one, you know?
Yes. Oh, look at him, how happy he gets.
Ireland, it's a great place. Great place. Okay, well, that's part one then, very festive. And we're going to be talking about robots that will take our jobs and kill us in part two. So, join us for that momentarily. So welcome to part two of the show. So Mary, you are special.
Oh, I know where this is going.
Where is it going?
To the universe.
It certainly is. You've been doing the same lesson as me about evolution.
Yes, but not as nicely as you, of course.
Probably. sorry, I sounded incredibly smug. But anyway, it was. It's a great talk, though, to be fair. It is a good TED talk, though, I think.
It's all right.
I know, I like it because I think I break it down in two parts. I don't know how you do it. For the first part, he talks about how evolution being, it's like misunderstood because people assume that we are the goal of evolution. We are the end point of evolution. And in fact, we are fish. And then he talks about how misunderstanding that can lead to problems like sexism and racism. And he expands in the second part of the talk about how we're all connected with branches on this tree of life. We are connected to other humans, to our ancestors, but also to other animals. And also animals that came before us who are now extinct. For example, the dinosaurs. Now, I do like this talk because he kind of makes the point that, you know, people assume, like, why are there still monkeys? If we evolved from monkeys, he's like, no, the fish came from, some came from the sea, developed a backbone, and some became primates, some became monkeys, and some became us. And how we're all interconnected in that way. I think he kind of makes a nice message about that.
Sorry, just when you said about backbone, I remember that my student was confused because he said that an octopus doesn't have a backbone.
He's right, though,
and
yeah.
And then I told him that an octopus is not a fish.
That's true, yeah.
And that was the end of the conversation. Okay.
It's also a confusing word there with fishes.
Yeah, and yeah. It's got a little note at the end, which is good because...
Which is handy, yeah, to be fair. But no, it's other stuff that I've seen as well, like, because I'm preparing another lesson which talks about where gold comes from, it being an extraterrestrial metal. And even the iron in our blood and the iron that we use as metal comes from outer space as well, from collisions and other objects hitting into each other and then that debris finding its way to Earth. And the oxygen that we breathe in this planet also comes from, like, animals that have been killed. Well, not killed, they've been slaughtered by big farm industries or something. But their bodies being compressed has produced the oxygen as well. So just this interconnectedness, even though it sounds very la-di-da and can be very... exactly. If only they could see your face right now. But I think it is beautiful in itself because I do think that we are the universe, which sounds crazy. But also, more pertinently, because as United Nations has said just this week, that we only have a generation to fix climate change, and after 12 years, the damage will be irreparable if we don't turn back the scale of what's happening. And as little as it is, these videos, I think, are interesting in maybe changing attitudes or just hammering home, you know, where we come from and what's at stake. You know, as beautiful as our planet is, it's even more beautiful when you consider how connected it is with the wider universe, you know, which I think is something that we can get lost in. Not lost in terms of, like, no, we get lost in terms of not really making that connection and often enough, which I think, it's a nice connection to make. And even on a smaller level, you know, losing the interconnectedness of us as a planet, then on that level, because we fall into traps of racism and jingoism and fear of immigration, for example. So even though on one level it's talking about something very macro, I think, well, I said it in one class, it's because of misunderstanding evolution, we have Brexit. exactly, it was a joke, but in a way it's kind of true, you know, very, very, very indirectly, of course, but I think there is an argument to be made, which I won't be doing now anyway. But we talk a little about Brexit first before we go into the killer robots and how they're going to take our jobs and our futures from us. But obviously you've been following Brexit a lot as well. Before I give my opinions on it is as it is now in its current stage, I don't know, is there anything that you want to say about it or, like, stuff that you've been following in the news about it?
Well, no, yesterday there was a debate which I think would have been slightly better because it was on Channel 4, which normally, like, Channel 4 News usually tries to see things in a more, well, they deal with a lot of, like, social issues and they do a lot of documentaries, so it's more of a reliable source of information, I think, than BBC, for example, at present. And, yeah, well, BBC have been, like, criticised a lot for, you know, being, like, impartial and so on.
I actually two little things. We won't go into this in much detail either because it's been covered in other podcasts. If you are a regular listener, you'll recognise this. But one was not connected to Brexit, but both of these relate to BBC. The BBC are doing a thing about influential women, maybe 100 of them. And this week they're talking about an Irish woman, who, to be fair, deserves to be mentioned. But they're talking about, like, in the backdrop of great social change. They put it in kind of like stronger terms, but I think they're typical media in that they're overselling the kind of radical social change that's been happening in Ireland. I think a lot of good things have happened in Ireland recently, but it's been an evolution of something that's already been there. There hasn't been a great rupture, but I think the BBC want to sell it like that so they can make the story more dramatic. But also there's always a suspicion that they always think Ireland is some backwater where, I don't know what they think sometimes, but I don't think it's an accurate reflection of what Ireland is. But more specifically related to Brexit, I was even listening to their most recent podcast about why it's so hard, and it is a very hard process, of course. But even talking about Northern Ireland there, you know, I think there's one telling moment because they were talking about how, like, years of violence led to the partition of the island. Now, as I was saying to you earlier, that year, those years of violence, in quotation marks, was the Irish War of Independence. I think it's very rare for other conflicts or other war independence movements to be so downgraded by language or by, I don't know, like an inability for their minds. And I mean, not all of them, but some minds in the BBC to fully understand like what that was, you know, because either they don't want to believe it or because they're too prejudiced to think that Ireland is a separate country. And I know it was only a small moment in the entire debate, but what I was telling was that when they're interviewing people from the BBC Northern Ireland, one guy said, well, Brexit is the process of Britain reckoning with its past, you know, in a way they probably have never done, and talking about how some of them will realise that Ireland is actually a separate country with its own will and aspirations. It's not going to fold and fall in line easily with what Britain wants, because, you know, if your interests don't align, it's not your right as a country to just to follow what the bigger neighbour wants you to do all the time, you know. So I think it's such a complex thing. I was reading today that most people are very conflicted about it, and I think we are all walking contradictions about it. But before I kind of talk more about it as well, I don't want to dominate the conversation. In Spain, I guess people do talk about it, no? I mean, in your family, or have you heard people in the metro or whatever?
Well, I mean, everybody just thinks it's stupid because, I mean, everybody has had, like, connections with the rest of Europe, and everybody just, like, as much as it's a bit like what we were talking about before, as much as Europe has a, you know, needs a renewal and has a lot of issues to deal with, that's one thing.
Yeah.
And the other thing is completely different, especially because, as what you said before, like off microphone, that they're not really trying to fix the European Union or talking about the concrete problems of the European Union, but rather focusing on, like, the same things that extremists could say in Spain.
Well, exactly. I mean,
you know, it's the same discourse or in
yeah.
America.
Well, because it is a populist rhetoric. And what we were talking about earlier is, because I listened to an Irish podcast with Eamon Dunphy talking to a former Irish MEP, member of the European Parliament. Now, she would consider herself, I think, liberal and Republican, so in some respects similar to myself, but she's campaigning for Brexit. She believes Brexit is a good thing because she's seen close-hand how undemocratic and how unwieldy it can be. And I don't doubt what she's saying. I think she is right in saying a lot of that. And I mean, and from an Irish perspective, NAMA, for example, during the crisis, we had set up a body called NAMA, which is like the National Assets Management body, basically, who had to take control of buildings and assets that, you know, couldn't be paid back, and they sell them off. And the European Union put them under pressure to sell them off for very low prices. So that's led to a situation where Ireland didn't receive as much money as it should have for a lot of these things, and which also has indirectly contributed to the housing crisis to a certain extent that we're experiencing now in the country. But even the idea of, like, burning the bondholders, like, a lot of people in the country wanted the banks to fail, but Europe didn't want that to happen. So if you burn the bondholders, it's a very famous statement reported in Ireland, that a bomb will go off in Dublin the next day, the European Union saying this to the Irish government and to the Irish Minister for Finance. So in a lot of ways, I think we probably were strong-armed into the paying back money to the European Union, and it was definitely going against our national interests. And because Ireland is also pro-European, sometimes to an extent that's too much, you know. It politicians, I think, in our country, in my country, are too quick to try please Europe over what is best for the country. Same in Spain then, okay. But the thing is, like, this MEP was saying this about Europe, and I don't doubt it, but as you were mentioning, and we mentioned off the microphone, that you know, it's not how the debate is being framed, though. I mean, this started with lies about immigration. This started with populist rhetoric. This started with false economic messages. You had Nigel Farage and Boris Johnson saying things about straight bananas, and, you know, quoting figures that they're paying for hospitals, you know, or for the European Union, that they could go back into hospitals. Everything that these people have been doing has proven to be wrong in terms of like how they've been handling the negotiations as being incompetent. Mm. The figures they've quoted have repeatedly been shown to be exposed to be false as well. And like the MEP was talking about as well how you know, Europe is being unfair. They're using Northern Ireland as a ploy to kind of a stick to beat England with. But I think she was arguing that not everybody who's voting for Brexit is some kind of racist or some guy who doesn't know, or a girl who doesn't know what they're voting for. And that's true, of course. But by the same token, I don't think you can paint the European Union, you know, in that same light. If you feel like you're being painted with the same brush, you can't, you know, paint the European Union with the broadest strokes. Either everybody's treated fairly or they're not. And I think, you know, it's what's important to keep in mind as well is that the European Union is, has to make it a tough negotiation, because she mentions in the podcast with Eamon Dunphy that they're worried about other countries with populist movements leaving Europe as well. But that's a very real threat, because if populism wins, Europe is going to be a lot worse as a continent. And having researched this for my thesis, and I've seen how it's more of an economic institution now than a human rights institution. I've seen how the European Union and its human rights bodies, and when they have sessions, how nobody attends. So I see that imbalance in what the European Union is. But fundamentally, it's something that was built to keep peace in Europe, and it's something that needs to be reformed from within. And if this was being done in an intellectually honest way, then there'd be room for that debate and even legitimacy for somebody leaving the European Union. But it's not being done in that way, and it's a complete farce, you know. And even thinking about things like immigration, you know, like countless studies show how immigrants don't cause more violence, they don't steal jobs, and they're not responsible for declining wages. Those are economic situations that are created outside of that fact. But that's what we keep hearing as well, that we're going to get our country back and we're going to kick immigrants out. And that's a thing you're going to hear in a lot of countries as well at the moment. And it's not true. It's not related to any economic reality or economic fact, you know.
Yeah, of course, like for us, it's obvious, no? I completely agree with that. But also, I think it's even more surreal because to me, it was just created out of nothing, because to be honest...
Well, opportunism, that's what it is. You know?
Yeah, in the sense that, well, out of nothing, no, out of a situation where a political party needed the support of a certain amount of, people to be able to govern. And then they just sold them something that a small group campaigned for, and they just sold them that in exchange for support. So it was just pure greed. So I put it all down to, like, you know, the Conservatives just wanted, you know, and Cameron in particular, just... you know, doing this deal to make sure that that he was in power. And then, because to be fair, I mean, you know, like lived in the UK for 8 years, I saw many things and I saw racist things and I saw whatever, but I never felt a claim or a need from people to any like small extent, even when I was in the area that has voted overwhelmingly for Leave in the Northeast, but there was no, you know, it wasn't like a daily debate by no means, and there was no feeling of people, you know, that was something that people were seeking. It was just like, you know, a suggestion of a few people, and then everybody bought into it and downloaded sort of like their you know, prejudice onto it, basically.
Yeah, well,
from my point of view.
No, I think that's true, but also, like we've spoken before about how, yeah, it was just a thing to keep Cameron in power, and then he lost control of the ship.
Well,
and
he just left. I mean, he'd done his bit, you know.
Well, if he hadn't lost the referendum,
he's happy and retired.
Well, yeah, if he hadn't lost the referendum, he would have stayed for a little bit longer. But in terms of, and anyway, these people like Rees-Mogg and Boris Johnson are the very elites that have hurt the working classes and don't have anything in common with those people.
Of course.
And they're the ones who are spearheading this. But one final thing we'd say as well, you know, most of the people that voted for Brexit don't live in places where there's immigrants. And most people who voted to stay in Europe live in places where there's immigration. Now, there's a recent episode of who's the mentalist? Derren Brown, where he convinces a racist Trump supporter to take a bullet for an illegal Mexican immigrant. But there's a psychological test they do where he sits down in front of a Mexican for like 15 minutes and they just stare at each other. And he starts crying because I think for the first time the penny drops that this Latino is an actual human being. But I think like, yeah, it's just this, it just never has been so clear that it's just fear is being preyed on, a specter of things. And there's nothing substantial behind that. And then once that is punctured, people are realize that immigrants aren't the devil. And if you listen to radio call-in shows, I can't remember this guy's name, but I listen to him quite a lot on YouTube because they upload clips of him answering questions on his radio show. And he always has the economic facts for this. And whenever he contradicts people, they're just like, well, that's what you're saying, but what I believe is this. And that's the only recourse that they have when it comes to this. Anyway, well, this is a long and complex debate, but we'll move on to the exhibition in the Fundación Telefónica in Gran Vía, focusing on National Geographic and also robots as well. So you start off this segment.
Well, it's connected, I suppose. We're talking about free will and the ability to make decisions by yourself, or like being programmed to think a certain thing. Yeah. And I think that ties in with the exhibition. The exhibition is a little bit about the story of like automatons. I don't know if you can say it in plural. Yeah. And well, just from the beginning, and even from Roman times, there was this idea of trying to do like little dolls or little creatures that perform very simple tasks. Becomes kind of like more popular from the Middle Ages, and then obviously in recent times it focused for a while on like playing games, for example like chess, that I told you about that, whether it was like you thought there was any particular reason why they focused on those things, and you told me they don't necessarily focus on that.
What I told you was like that these are just like you can program the movements very easily. It's like programming a music box, which is what they did at various points in history as well, going back. So I think it's something that's easily programmable. Obviously, chess is a very intricate game. It's only now that you can get AI. Well, even back in the 80s, I think they had computers that they were experimenting with, Deep Blue being one of them. But I think, it's just a simple thing that chess is very popular, and it's a very programmable thing because you just have a range of movements, and at that time obviously more limited than a skilled human player, and very limited compared to what AI can do now and even in the 80s. But I think that was just a simple fact of why they did it.
Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, those were just the first steps of trying to create some sort of robot, and then nowadays is kind of like artificial intelligence, which is not just about doing something that a machine, a device has been programmed for, but also for that machine to be able to think for themselves.
Exactly, yeah. Well, it's an interesting exhibition because it shows like those original incarnations, but also how robots look in popular culture as well. Now, we had a bit of a disagreement about free will.
I don't think it was a disagreement.
Well, I just think like that, it's just, you know, what they're aiming for are humans that are robots that can replicate the human experience, but that's all it's going to be, really, just a simulacra, like an echo of what it is to be human, you know, because like they showed art done by robots, and as I said to you there, even if I knew a beautiful painting was done by a robot, I don't think I'd ever feel any connection to it because I don't think there's any soul behind it. But what I do think is interesting is that, like, going back to Derren Brown for a second, like I've heard people saying, well, they're so predictable and maybe we will be inferior to machines because machines will be able to predict all of our desires or what we need in a specific moment, because we are probably, you know, we probably have less free will than we think, and we probably do just a limited range of motions or actions at any given time. But since Derren Brown and these kind of skilled mentalists exist where they can kind of predict human behavior, then it's kind of I'm more at ease with this, because if a machine does end up doing that, I know a human's been there first, you know, being able to do it. But it is fascinating because, like, I've been researching this a lot over the last few months and reading a lot about it. Obviously, their view of this is very hopeful and very positive, and this is of course, is true. Like, they will be able to do a lot of things, like defusing bombs or flying airplanes and fighting wars, perhaps, as well. So, I mean, it's not going to be all bad, but in terms of what is bad, obviously, you have increased automation. I think a lot of low-skilled jobs are going to go first, and then even high-skilled jobs, like, as I was saying to you that day as well, in terms of the stock exchange, a lot of that is run by AI as well. And I just don't know what's going to happen to us in the future if we're going to be very de-skilled, because we've already lost bushcraft skills. As you know, do you know how to light a fire in the woods? No, you don't. Neither do I. And pretty soon, perhaps, we'll be losing these basic abilities of being able to be, you know, functional adults that have skills. Because, well, we'll be okay because we've grown up in that environment. But in the future generations, if everything is automated, what does that mean for people in terms of education and skill aggregation? Are they going to be just infants, you know, with their every need catered for, with only a few people who have an interest and the knowledge to kind of maintain this structure?
Well, I think there was an important point that we talked about, which was humanity, is that more and more, the more we progress, for lack of a better word, the more we focus on science and less in art or in humanities. And we see that, for example, like in teachings at school and at university, for example, in Spain, like things like philosophy or like humanities are receding. But I think, you know, a little tiny with what you were saying before, that's a characteristic of like human beings, that if anything is the hardest to reproduce. So we might, how that will be applied to kind of like making a living, I don't know how that will tie in with like losing employment and so on.
Yeah.
But there is that thing which is essentially human, because many other creatures, you know, living creatures can do things, practical things, and things for the community, and things to feed themselves and to create shelter and so on, like you were saying about the fire. But as far as we know, there aren't, you know, any other creatures that can create things like poetry, for example.
Well, I remember that as well. But like, the thing is, they will be producing poetry in the future, because that's what they're designing them to do as well, to do everything. And we'll be falling in love with them, having physical relationship with them as well. But also, well, not all of us, but they
would. I suppose, like, that's where we differ, that this one, actually.
But no, but I think what I was trying to say to you is, so like, because you were saying that because they'll be able to do it, they'll be human, will have some type of humanity or whatever. But I just think like that the impulse that drives a lot of what we do is because it's rooted or hardwired in us for socialization, for bonding, for the continuation of the species. Now, also on the other side of the coin, by using those terms, like, it's hardwired into us, it's like using the language of coding and programming. And we know from other animals as well, like, for example, birds, a lot of species of birds, their bird song is in their DNA, or even young birds will know where to migrate to without even being taught where to go. It's just something that's instinctive in them as well. So, like, those things are more confusing to understand, I guess, because those would seem to be more of a living creature's under like a living creature's autonomy. You know, it's something that, it's like a decision making process or something that involves some kind of life capacity, if you know what I mean. But you know, if we do have that kind of program, I still think what we have is to is underpinned by this biological impulse. You know, but then again, I contradict myself here. But then a programmer could say, well, if we put that into a robot, this deep learning technology, well, then they will probably do that to become better and to build relationships either with other robots or with a network or with humans as well. So, but again, it's I'll never be able to say yes, you know, black or white, but it still seems it will be like an artificial replication of what we are doing naturally, you know? But I think,
just, yeah. I don't know. I don't. I'm perhaps I'm less negative in that respect. As in, I don't envisage them like replacing humans or trying to.
Well, the thing is, like, replacing humans seems like it sounds like a very like graphic sci-fi kind of term. But I think in terms of like how our society is going to be organized, how we're going to be, yeah, you know, we're already not working 9 to 5. We already are working the gig economy. You know, so many things are changing. You know, this is also feeds into ideas of universal basic income. You know, if we need to be have universal basic income because we won't have enough jobs. But also why won't we have enough jobs is because they'll be automated. And not just the factory jobs, but shops, stock exchanges, and lots of things as well.
Yeah, but then it goes back to what we were saying the other day. You know, it's a, I see it as two separate things. You know, there's one thing to worry about in terms of like robots and so on. Practically... taking people's jobs and how we're gonna fix the issue of those people like surviving and having an income, and there's the other philosophical topic of whether robots would or can replace humans, not in a, you know, in a sci-fi way, but in the sense of that you were saying that you know, if you teach them like how to do and how to like have the emotions and all that, that eventually they will develop them themselves. But I think in reality, I envisage more a scenario that I don't think is gonna arrive for a very, very, very long time, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because as I said to you, I think, you know, things in history always revert in a way when humans see themselves in danger. Somehow something comes up that stops that process, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So I don't think it'll happen in the near future. But then you know, I envisage more kind of like the idea of robots being like another race, to, for lack of a better word, coexisting with humans rather than, you know, with their distinctive distinct abilities and distinct characteristics, even like in terms of like production, artistic production, or so on.
Yeah, but like I know studies have shown people can generate affection towards these creatures. We saw also in the exhibition that people with Alzheimer's and old people are treated with robot animals that kind of respond in certain ways. So I mean, like, they have their place, but I think in terms of you know, the danger, I mean, the people could talk about an event horizon. Philosophers talk about an event horizon as well, where their development and their advancement far strips what we can control. And, you know, I talked about the experiment as well, where two computers were put talking to each other, and within minutes they developed an entirely new language as well. So in many ways, it's like it's difficult. I mean, it's difficult to project or predict what's going to happen. You know, you're running an experiment, but then the results are widely unpredictable, I think, in some respects. But in terms of going back as well to what they are, yep, okay, they're going to have this place in society as service things, I guess. But I don't know. I just think, like, I got the impression from the exhibition that you know, they're getting off on making these things as humanistic as possible. And I don't know. I just, like, think, I mentioned this documentary before, AlphaGo. Go is a game that's a lot more sophisticated than chess. It has more range of movements and is very complex. And the world champion of that was pitted against a computer program. And now, of course, it's very interesting because the people who made the computer program were also kind of rooting for humanity as well to win these series of games. But what I was saying is, like, the human player has stress, has fatigue, has sadness when he loses, has fans to cheer him up, has ambition and all these things as well. So I just think, like, obviously it's exciting that these technologies can do these things, but, like, you know, I don't know what their end goal is, to create machines that can just to demonstrate that they're sophisticated and so they can beat a human in the game, or I don't know what the surrounding philosophy is when they're doing these kind of programs. You know, maybe I'm too pessimistic about it, but I don't know. I just think,
well, you know, I think it's a way of like feeling under control, kind of like playing God to a point, you know, because at least that's something that if robots developed as a race, let's say, you know, humans would know that they were created by them. So it's like a sense of ownership that is lacking for many people that think, well, we don't know where we come from and who created us, you know, for people that are not religious. So yeah. Then at least like this has a kind of like a beginning, like a marked beginning where you can say, well, this was created by us as human beings.
Yeah.
So it's like a new, it's like a further dimension of creation that we cannot have at the moment because we didn't create any living beings. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They were put with us. So I think that's, I think it's in a way, it's like self-centered human ambition, to be honest.
But I just think, like going back to what I said about losing skills, I mean, this is demonstrable even now. I mean, I mentioned this in a previous podcast as well, but an Air France disaster where basically the humans didn't know there was an error in the computer that was flying the plane, basically. And even if they had known, you know, the computer was at fault, they wouldn't have had enough experience to jump in and correct the problem manually, you know. So I think it's like going, you know, it's like politics. I mentioned this before as well. People always say, oh, you should go for politics or whatever. And then the time like Bernadette McCluskey, she like in a podcast with Blind Boy, she was complaining that people always say, oh, I should go for politics, but why should I when you could go, for example? Because we have this thing in our society where it's always like, you know, if only this person was in power, things would be much better, for example. I think it's just a way to transfer responsibility and have the illusion of a more comfortable life, but in reality, it's just not going to solve anything related to our deepest questions, you know, or even improve society. Well, in certain respects, of course, it will. You know, robots that can perform surgery, never get tired, all those kind of menial tasks, I think, will be very beneficial. But, you know, there are going to be a lot of problems socially with you know, with romantic relationships, with ideas of what these robots are, and kind of relating to them on a human level as well. So I think, you know, these exhibitions are really cool for showing like the possibilities of technology as well. But I think there's going to be such a social price to pay for this as well, that in the interest of balance, these things should be considered more, I think, in exhibitions, you know, on the subjects of robots. And they're not enough. Yeah. It's not the same, as soon as it's kind of swept under the carpet, I think, a little bit.
Well, but you could also see it from the opposite point of view, which is that, for example, all right, you were very interested in this and have been reading about it for months.
Yeah.
But many other people perhaps are not aware of like the scale of things in terms of developing robots. And when you go to the exhibition, it kind of like become aware of how much it's developed, and especially with regards to like, the time span, because I was saying to you, well, not much has happened, but then when you think of like the whole history and how much it's developed in so little time, then, well, I think it makes you more aware of the dangers of the situation. So in a way, I think it's good that people are more exposed to it.
Well, probably, I don't know. I guess people are different and have different takeaways to... what's that?
To play devil's advocate.
I think
it's true, because, for example, like, we might have not been discussing it, you know, to such an extent if we hadn't been to the exhibition, so...
Yeah. All right, well, I have nothing more to say about this, okay. I think. Anything else you want to add before we go to part three?
No, nothing else.
All right, then. So, even though I've been trashing robots for the last 20 minutes, I'll be pressing stop on my computer here, and 8 minutes later on the said computer, and plugging out my microphone, which might be plotting my destruction. God bless you. So, my finger is hovering over the record button, and this is the time he chose to sneeze.
Because I was just about to tell you, don't press it.
That's an underused mute button on this new microphone. Cough button. Doesn't matter. Are you done?
I think so, but you know, you cannot control when you sneeze.
That's true, it is involuntary. Even though you do, bizarrely, keep your eyes open when you do it.
Okay, fair enough. I'll try to close them next time.
Yeah, that would be the human thing to do. Do you know where Christmas comes from? Well, I mean, human in terms of like, it's biologically impossible to keep your eyes open.
And do I?
No, of course not.
Oh, right, because you just said I do. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, that was...
Christmas. Christmas comes from Jesus? What are you talking about?
No, I think Chris... I didn't say that, Jesus. Christmas comes... Well, you know Jesus was born in June, don't you? As a segue.
I don't think they had the same calendar then.
Maybe not, but I think roughly doing the calculations. But obviously Christmas is based on winter festivals. Even
Right.
Yeah. Thank you, doctor, for giving me that concession. I was going to say...
Solstice,
yeah. Yeah, well, not the solstice, but I keep wanting to say Romanian. I mean, I want to say Roman.
Yeah, Roman festival of the...
Saturnalia.
Yeah.
Where the servants became the masters and the masters became the servants for one day. You know that aspect of it, no?
Yes. No, yeah. I was thinking like it's also like the sun, the...
Yeah.
Well, I can't remember. But it's related to the solstice.
Yeah, well...
It's got a name in Latin, I can't remember.
It's interesting because... Excuse me. It's interesting because we mentioned Carnival in other podcasts as well, where it was kind of common for men to dress up as women and women to dress up as men. Rich to be poor, poor to be rich. So even though Carnival is a medieval celebration, you kind of see that aspect, that facility of these ancient festivals as well, where you kind of like, because society was so structured, you kind of use this as an opportunity to switch social roles for a minute. And beyond that, I have no more profundity to talk about that, but it's kind of like interesting detail about where Christmas comes from. But also as well, in classes, I've been showing my students about the Chinese factories that make Christmas decorations all year round. Have you seen those?
No, I haven't. You just like spoiling Christmas.
Well, it's funny because they have no idea what it's for, you know? Like, they're covered in snow, or like Santa hats, and they have no idea what it is, you know?
Really? But yeah. Surely, like, you know what Christmas is.
The Christian population in China is only like 4 to 6%.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, it's like us with like Chinese New Year.
Yeah, but like...
You know what's going on in... Well,
yeah, but we're
might,
not...
You might not know the...
Yeah, but we're not like trying to suppress... You know, Chinese New Year. But I imagine that...
What do you mean we're not?
Well, I imagine Christmas is something that is... Well, I'm just guessing. I could be completely wrong, but I imagine that it is something that's tightly controlled. Because it is a communist country with a deep suspicion of religion. And related to Christmas, I'm not sure if we did mention this in the podcast before, but I definitely told you off camera, off microphone, Jesus, like this guy who was part of Falun Gong. That's what they're called, no?
No.
What are they called?
I don't know.
The Falun Gong. The religious sect in China. I'm pretty sure it's that, but if it's not, we'll put it into the link description. But they have been put under control by the Chinese government for decades, really, because they're worried about people who can kind of meet in such numbers, you know? And one guy who was in this prison... was forced to, well, he's a member of this religious order, and he was forced to make Christmas decorations and also other decorations like for Halloween, and he smuggled a note out in English to a woman who found it in America like 2 years after she bought this thing, and looking for help. And then, no, this is a true story, it's in the New York Times and everything and in the Guardian. And then she contacted the local, like, some human rights organization. They contacted the media. And then, like, the media put him in touch with her, or her in touch with him. They met in Hong Kong, where he was, like, living now, because he'd been released from prison. But then he died in mysterious circumstances not long after. So we don't know what happened with him. So, yeah, Christmas, eh?
You're very Christmassy today.
Yeah, well, no, it's such, like, we do take for granted, but, like, every decoration that we have comes from China. So, you know, there's like, many sides of that coin. Interesting ones and kind of maybe negative ones as well. But anyway, apart from that, here's the time. Speaking of communism, you gotta plug a republic there for us of the radio kind.
Well, okay. So if you listen to us on Radio Public,
yeah,
you help us do what we do best or worst.
Exactly.
Just what we do, basically.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that's the hard sell again. So yeah, listen to us on any platform that you want, but Radio Public is one where it generates income if you do listen to us. We always appreciate that, but never fear, the podcast is free. Always for you, dear listener, and you can. We always appreciate you, even if you do listen to us on other platforms. You can find us on Instagram, Twitter, on YouTube, and our blog, as I said in part one, is irishsliceofmadrid.wordpress.com. So, I think that is pretty much everything for part three of the show.
That's it for the year? No, no, we must have.
We'll do show 101 next week, but then it'll be done for the year, yeah?
Yeah.
Take a hiatus and we'll begin with episode 102 in January. We can talk about the festivities, the presents.
Three kings.
The Roscon.
Yeah.
The Turon.
Chocolate.
The Polverones.
Hmm.
The fights. The turkey.
The fights.
You know, throwing turkey legs across the dinner table at your family.
Yeah. All shrimp.
Shrimp. Yeah, well, we'll be more of this banter in next week's show because it'll be even closer to Christmas, so we can riff on that a little bit more. But for now, thank you very much for listening to this and for all the other 100 episodes or the other 99 episodes. And we'll be talking to you next week. Where will we be doing more of this?
Christmassy stuff?
No, just culture talking.
Well, all right then.
And terrible mental arithmetic. All right then, thank you very much. The Alarpa Podcast, the home for cultural chit-chat in and outside Madrid. People will talk.